All right. Well, thank you guys all for coming. My name is Jack. This is Scott. And we're both from PlayStation, but today we're not going to talk a whole heck of a lot about PlayStation. We're just going to talk about games, specifically a trend that Scott and I are super into these days, and that's sort of this collision of casual and social games with more core games like shooters and racers. And what's happening? Where's this whole industry going over the next 5 or 10 years? And what are the new kinds of games that we're seeing out there? I think you know, one of the things that Scott really wants us to do here is make it a more open dialogue. I think it's a great idea. So, you know, we don't want to just be talking at you guys. We want to make sure that we're covering the kinds of stuff that you guys want to hear. So feel free to walk up to that mic right there and just hammer us with questions. I've got a bunch of slides here. Each slide has one word on it, and it's meant to just sort of generate a conversation. So I'm going to kind of flip to a slide, and we're just going to go for it. And we're going to talk about that word and what it means for the future of games. And then if you guys feel compelled to say something, don't hesitate. Stand up there and go to the mic. It's going to make it a ton more interesting to just make this more interactive. So, Scott, why don't you introduce yourself?
Yeah, thanks, Jack. So I am my name's Scott Rohde, and I manage all the development studios in North America for PlayStation. So Sucker Punch, Naughty Dog, San Diego Studio, Foster City Studio, Bend Studio, Santa Monica Studio. There's a whole bunch of them. And pretty exciting job for me. Honestly, it's still one of those jobs where you got to pinch yourself every single day. Loved games my whole life. Still get to do it, you know, every day of my life. And glad to see all you guys here. What are you pointing at?
Oh, Hellfire. Okay. One of our developers.
So anyways, just like Jack said, really, really want to keep this super interactive and just, you know, fire out questions. Just, you know, feel free to, if you don't feel like running back to the mic, just yell it out, because I want this to be interactive. There's not a lot of content on these slides. Let's just make this kind of a fun talky time in here. So
you got it.
You want to talk about who you are?
Sure. So I'm Jack. I head up what's called PlayStation Digital Platforms. So that includes PlayStation Network, as well as PlayStation Home, and even new platforms like PlayStation Suite. So basically, if it's digital and it's PlayStation, that's what I do. And again, you know, there's lots of self-pinching going on as well in my role, because we're really
sounded
at the
gross when you say that.
Because we're dealing with the absolute cutting edge of this industry. There's so much innovation going on in this space, and so, you know, that's kind of what we're going to be talking about today, which is, you know, not so much about where the industry is right now, but where we're going to be 5 years from now and what's going to happen when these two different game types collide. So without further ado,
why don't we jump
into the first topic, core. So what is a core game? Anybody want to throw out a definition of what they think a core game is?
Come on, don't be shy. Someone talk first. Yeah. Say again. Something that grabs you for a really long time, kind of takes over your life for some long Skyrim-like period of time. Okay, got it. Okay.
70 hours deep right here. any other ideas? Yeah?
High degree of complexity in terms of engagement and interaction.
Great, so give us some examples.
So, I mean, Skyrim, for example, lots of mechanics, lots of things to figure out. Modern Warfare, again, lots of mechanics, high skill factor in order to be competitive. Mm-hmm.
So, can a does a game have to be long to be a core game?
Not in my mind.
Why not?
Because you can get, I mean, we define long, right? You can get
Skyrim is very long.
Yes. $100.
Yes, it is. All right, good.
All right.
I think you can get that same level of complexity and that same level of engagement, long-term engagement in a short time frame. Define time by length, by time to play, it doesn't have to be long.
Interesting.
Can something that, you know, is broadly defined as a casual game, like let's just take a, you know, a popular iOS game like Jetpack Joyride, right? Can that be core or is it casual? Where does it land?
I think it can absolutely be core. Yeah. But I think to some extent it is. At a point where your engagement with it changes from casual interaction or that 30 to 60 seconds that you're playing into a whole prolonged experience where you're really taking advantage of all of the built-in replayability.
Cool. Go on, Gordon.
Core sort of just feels more about what you can do to prepare before you play. Like whether it be like a fighting game like Street Fighter or a sports game or an RTS, like core games there's a lot of thought you can put into your execution before you start. Like a casual game like Tetris or Bubble Bobble, it just sort of, you know, you play it as it comes.
And you're dating yourself, Gordon.
Bubble Bobble. Anyone? Bubble Bobble? All right! Going back there.
A core game requires a high degree of gaming literacy to play.
That's good.
I think that's a good way to put it, absolutely.
So, gaming literacy. Boy, I like that topic. What do you mean, gaming literacy?
Well, obviously I'm using a word like literacy, because we don't have a good equivalent for it, but maybe the Germans will give us one. But essentially, familiarity with their interfaces, with how you play games, how you follow quests and commands and structures. It can be long, it can be short, it can be indefinite, it can even be shallow, but usually it requires gaming competency.
Yeah, I think it's a really good point, and to me, that's why some games end up taking off into the stratosphere, like, you know, like the success Call of Duty is seeing, or like, you know, really popular sports games. When you have a set of mechanics that you have to build on from game to game to game, and you're expected to know those on day one, or else you're going to get your butt handed to you. I think that does define core literacy in games.
Barrier to entry. A lot of casual games have, you can learn them in like 5 minutes. Core games are going to end up taking a while to learn. And also how much time you plot down to play the games. If you're going to play a core game, you're expected to put down more, at least an hour or more. Whereas casual games, you just sit down, play for 5 minutes, and you can just drop them.
Yeah, I think it's a really good point as well. I think that the best core games can bridge that gap. Right.
Yep.
By basically easing the players into all those mechanics over that first 2-3 hours of experience, and they won't know that they've learned, you know, 15 new skills over the first 3 hours, but they have, and they're starting to become competent with them.
All right, so everybody got a good sense of core. You ready for the next slide? Let's see what we got. Uh-oh. What's that game? Anybody? All right, Rock Band. Is that core or casual? Did I make a mistake on this slide? Go on.
I'd say that's a little bit both, because it is casual enough to where I could get together with 3 or 4 other people in this room, and no matter what we know about games, we can play. At the same time, though, I could get together with 3 or 4 other people in this room who have played a lot, and we could play on a competitive scale. It bridges you, or it gives you the ability to walk from casual up to a skill of competitive, where then we could brag and say, you know, I'd be Dragon Force.
Yeah.
Not many people saying, "Yeah, my grandma beat Dragon Force." She's actually getting angry.
To agree with them, I think based on Rock Band's like different difficulty levels, my mom can sit down and sing a Bon Jovi song on easy, but then I can go in and play a Rush song on pro drums and tear it up.
Nice.
Geddy Lee. So I think that, you know, both of you guys are making a really good point. You know, something like this is unique in that you can have a super hardcore guy on the drums or on the guitar, and mom can show up on the mic, and it still works. And that's what made a game like that pretty unique.
Go on.
So I think that also begs the question of how does the player, you know, contribute to whether it's a core or a casual game? So you can have someone that plays like a Facebook game, which someone would play 5 minutes a day, but they play hours a day and get to like the very last level. And so to them, it may be more of that investment, but to someone else, it may not be. So then you kind of have a subjective aspect of it as well.
Yeah, I think you're right. I'm gonna flip the tables on you a little bit. So we put this up here, and there's sort of kind of 50-50. It's kind of core, it's kind of casual. Would anyone in here call Call of Duty casual in any way?
Ooh. Go on.
You saying yes, or you want to comment?
Yeah, I think it can definitely be casual. I think it's a perspective that a lot of gamers have, that because like if you're shooting people and stuff like that, it's automatically core. I know a couple of friends who just start up Team Deathmatch, play for like 20 minutes, and they're like, okay, I'm done.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, shooting people is very casual in America. Yes.
I agree that with what you were talking about gaming literacy, not everyone can sit down. If they've never played a dual analog shooter, they can't sit down and play Call of Duty without knowing how to direct your head,
yeah, that's right,
move forward and do all that. But someone who does know the basics of that can sit down and play for 10 minutes.
Yeah, my favorite episode of The Office is when Jim Halpert is stuck in the corner jumping up and down in the corner because he can't figure out the controls, right?
Right. That's so true. That's so good. All right, you're right. Okay, anybody else before we go on to the next one?
Just a quick kind of, to flip on Call of Duty being casual, could we go and say something like Farmville? Are there hardcore Farmville
players? Guilty. Yeah. You know, I had to drop that habit like smoking, and I kid you not, right? And I'll say it right now, I'm done with that kind of game for a while at least, right? But when that first came out, and it was kind of the first one that really kind of went into the stratosphere, and God knows what drew me in, but yeah, I was head over heels into making my farm cooler than anyone else, and for some odd reason, I was proud of that.
I'm sure you probably compare that to like hardcore.
Oh, heck, let's just do it. There we go.
Absolutely.
All right, let's do it. Let's just.
You're ruining my slides.
But I put them in an order.
You want to say something here in the front?
Yeah,
sorry.
Hey, let's talk about the big stuff, so I don't want to.
No, go on.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
I can flip.
Well, I was thinking it's a lot easier to compare the consumers and like the players to a casual and core audience rather than the games to a casual.
That's a good point.
Because, I mean, a lot of people can take a game aimed at casuals and make it a cool game by looking at the things that really make it unique, you know, making it unique to them and playing it, putting a lot of hours into it, having a really strong emotional commitment to the game. And that makes them a core gamer for that maybe casual game.
It's interesting. I mean, I kind of half agree because I you know, I'll play Infamous in a very core way, but then I might sit on my bed and play Bejeweled Blitz for, you know, 10 minutes, right? Or maybe 2 hours on accident, right? But I think the point, and so maybe that does make me a core audience because I play a casual game for 2 hours, right? But I think that the point is they definitely cross over to different folks.
I really hope this isn't your last slide, but there's talk in the industry as well about essentially like the mid-core gamers, which is like kind of what you're talking about here, kind of that middle person, and then essentially, you know, that's a whole new group. It's a whole new description. Yep. How do you do that today?
Leave it to corporate America to put every single human being in a box. I love
that's
it.
Right.
Right?
That's right. Yeah. All right, let's flip a slide.
You want to comment, you know, on...
No.
Yeah. All right.
I guess, like, to go back to follow up on that, I guess this sort of shows also with the sales of Call of Duty. Like, a lot of people don't view it just as a hardcore game. Because I feel like if it was just a hardcore game, it would only appeal to a limited audience. But because it appeals to beyond just the hardcore, it sells extremely well.
You could absolutely make the argument that Call of Duty is, in our time right now, the most core, the most casual, and even the most social game. All in one. You know, you really could make that argument.
Let's switch gears here. Ready? I'm going to blow your mind. Boom. People have been playing games for a very long time.
You got the cheese on.
That's right.
Right now.
That's
like
right.
Yeah.
So this is something that I don't think a lot of people think about, but this slide is really meant to show this human need for play. And that these discussions we're having right now could be equally applicable to people playing that game thousands of years ago. Would you agree?
Like how social was that? I mean, you know, you think back then there was no, and this is kind of the reason you put this slide up here,
uh-huh.
There was no way to sit in front of a computer screen and play whatever that game is against an AI opponent, right? So you absolutely had to be social, whether you liked it or not, to sit down and play that game.
So the idea of a single-player game is strangely a product of the 1970s, when you could actually build a computer that would play against somebody. You had some exceptions. You had solitaire, and you had games you could play by yourself back in the day. But to Scott's point, games were social by definition.
Scott's social by definition.
The games were social by definition. Yes, back.
I say you bring up solitaire. There's also Ball in a Cup, Hoop in a Stick. Yeah. There's plenty of games that people develop to play by themselves. That pegboard version of solitaire.
That's good.
There's a version of Go that they designed to play with one person. There are actually plenty of games that people developed specifically for the person who found themselves alone frequently.
Great point.
So in this respect, like looking back on ancient games, how could you define like a hardcore game versus a casual game?
Very good question. Anybody want to address that?
Let's take a look at just two of the more, I guess, older game back games. What if you compare chess to something like Foursquare or Hopscotch? We could say that, you know, the games you can play like Hoop on a Stick,
could be compared to like a solitaire game where one might not be as, if you go to like gaming literacy, I can't sit down and start playing chess. But if you show me a number of hopscotch area, I'll figure it out in an instant.
Getting back to the question of how do you define core versus casual and ancient games, I wonder if it's, if it, at that point was a level, was from the point of view of the intellect, you know, the tic-tac-toe versus chess, Go versus, I don't know, whether that could have been the definition at that point.
I'm actually taking a class that studies games, and we have to read various definitions on the term game, whether it's from Huizenga or Caudwell or any stuff like that. And a game is just essentially, it's artificial, it has players, it has conflict, it has rules. And it has the end result.
Are you reading that definition?
Yeah.
Yeah, he is. He's studying.
But essentially, it's the more systems we get, the more rules we add on. And back then, there were no complex systems, no complex rules to possess.
So let me ask a quick question just based on that before I get to you, Gordon. Was it better when there were fewer complex systems, or is it better now when you can have, you know, a set of the most complex systems ever imagined, you know, coming out every month or something new?
I don't think it matters of how many rules or how many systems or rules we have. It's a matter of implementation. As long as it's done well and effectively, then I don't think it matters.
Okay. Really sorry, before we get you, Gordon had his hand up here.
Yeah. Rules, I think a lot about menus, right, as sort of the bridge to get to games. Think of like a board game, right? It has a big, thick rule book. You're like, this is hardcore.
Yeah.
And it has like a one page, you're like, we can now play.
Yeah.
And games are sort of the same way. Like, you talk about Rock Band or Call of Duty. Like, if you're casual, you probably can't even start a song in Rock Band or start a level in Call of Duty. But hardcore people can sort of get you there.
That's true.
In which case, it's very casual. Because just start shooting or just start singing is sort of your rule book. And that's
a great point.
I think it sort of seems like the game's kind of more adapted to the player. Like, it's not so much is it better to have less complex or like more complex. It depends on what the player is looking for. Like, in all these games, it's the customizations just gone off the map. Like, one of my favorite games, Madden, or whatever. You've been able to create your own player for a long time. You can look exactly like you.
Yeah.
And you can adjust the complexity of the game to your level.
No, it's a good point. Absolutely. So flexibility is more important than segmentation. Yeah. Someone over here. Yeah.
Just a brief.
Yeah.
If your game is fun and it has one rule, but it's still fun, it doesn't hurt anything.
Yeah.
If people are finding it fun, they should play it. Like, you know, checkers is extremely simple. People still play it because it's fun.
Mm-hmm.
Same with chess. Chess is extremely, well, not extremely, but it's very complex. People still play it because it's fun.
Yeah.
Let me challenge you really quick. Do people still play checkers because it's really fun, or because both people know because both people know, you know, how to play it? Because that's a pretty big factor as well, I think.
I think it depends. So for the most part, you know, if you have a younger child and you're teaching how to play, they're going to have a lot of fun as they're learning it.
And they can play against grandpa, and so it works. Yeah. Yeah.
So they grow up into chess, or they grow up into Go, or something like that.
Or if you're like my kids, they draw little pictures on the checkers and they have a whole new set of rules and they say, come play this with me, Daddy. Right?
That's right.
Do you want to say something else?
I was just going to say, you know, to what extent do you guys think that ancient games, especially games in general, have grown out of a need for competition that we have?
Yeah.
Out of a need to interact with something, right? Whether it's somebody else in kind of a strategic battle.
We talk about this a lot.
That's huge, and I bet you're covering that in your class. I mean, that need for competition is probably a big driver for all games of the past. What's that?
We have to fight for our grade.
Yeah. Yeah? That's cool.
We talk a lot about, you know, what we stand for, you know, when we're designing games or we're designing our systems, and we always say, you know, we're all about the gamer. And why is that? And who is a gamer? And you think about that long enough and you realize that almost everyone has this very innate human need for play, right? It doesn't matter where you go in the world. Doesn't matter who you talk to. Everybody has their own sense of what it means to play. And I think that's one of the reasons why you see games so prevalent in human society. It's almost like language. It's like it's built into us. We can't help ourselves. We have to play.
It seems like games started when we no longer needed to fight for our lives every day. It's like they started coming about when it was no longer hunting all day long just to survive. And it sort of replaces that.
That's interesting.
So we sort of hunt for those needs that we no longer have to fulfill, you know, in everyday life. Nature.
Yeah, now we have the exact opposite problem where people have to find the reason not to play games to do basic things like bathe and eat, right? It's
yes.
important.
Yeah. Yes. So, yeah. How many hours is Skyrim?
I'm not sure if that's necessarily valid because, like, if you think about it, like, probably the first games we played are when we were, like, really little kids and we're like, over there, that's lava, and that, like, that tree is our base. And we have to, like,
yeah.
Love that game. Already, but you set up, like, these artificial constraints already as a child that, like, are going to.
So,
do you want to say something real quick?
Well, I mean, kind of going off what both these guys are saying, you can also look at play as, you know, in the natural world, almost all animals play. And a lot of youthful, you know, wolves, orcas, I mean, a lot of intelligent, obviously intelligent animals use play as a method of teaching and development. And I think that is
that's a good point. That is a good point.
Of play in society is not only do people build social skills by interacting with people, but we learn real world things, whether it be to avoid things that are dangerous or to compete with somebody so that we survive.
Yep. Sure. There's a very good book I would recommend called On Intelligence. It's actually written by a neuroscientist, and it's a book about what does the human mind do? What does your brain do? And there's a couple chapters in the book that are, you know, all about the biology of the brain. But one of the sort of central themes is that your brain is built to actually learn from the past and, as a result, predict things about what's going to happen in the future. So this idea that you touch a hot burner on a stove and it's hot, you lift your hand away, it's like, ow, that's hot. Okay, next time I see a red burner on a stove, I'm not going to put my hand on it anymore because I'm probably going to burn myself. And so there's a whole interesting discussion you can have around games and around how that engages that part of your brain where you start to just see these patterns and you can start to predict what your opponent is going to do, or in this case, what the computer is going to do. That just makes you feel good. And in many ways, that is fun because that's what your brain does. Pretty interesting stuff.
Well, and with that, I think, you know, one of the major roles of games in society, we talk a lot about games as education. And what I don't think a lot of people realize is when you apply games, you're teaching somebody in a safe way. I mean, we have a virtual environment. And if you take Assassin's Creed, you know, you jump off a 200-story building, you fall and you die. That's a safe way to
understand. kids pay attention.
Ways people can learn that lesson, yes, absolutely. Yeah.
This is why 5 year-olds should be playing Assassin's Creed.
Come on.
Let's go in the
Where's
back.
The SRB? Well,
yeah. Assassin's Creed thing.
Sorry.
There's a big bale of hay.
Yeah.
Just
bale of hay is totally safe, by the way. That's cool.
And they actually knew some words, some Italian words.
That's great.
It's pretty neat, you know. So when you tell people who are not into games and you bring that about, they say, well, you know, I hadn't thought about it that way. So
yeah.
I think there's a lot of things that we can draw from that. And the person who's playing is not even, you know, realizing that. They're just, you know, oh, yeah, I have to go to that place.
Absolutely. You got to put that point in front of all that anti-video game regulation out there.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really true. I mean, I think you learn an awful lot about not just places and people, but just in general, just logic and strategy. I mean, these are important values for life, says the biased guy at the microphone. But absolutely. Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about what happened in the 70s. Because something very
talk a little bit about what happened in the 70s.
After this panel, actually, we'll go. I want to talk about what happened with the introduction of electronic games. And I want to talk. Did games change, or did they just find a new medium? Did anything significant happen when we started to play games, electronic games? Was that fundamental to the notion of what fun or social or core is, or is it just the same thing all over again?
I think
not real, but something virtual. And with vibrant colors, well, not at first, but with colors and things moving around, it just intrigues you. You're like, oh my goodness, like, I'm here, but I'm also in there. It just draws you in.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the biggest appeals to it. And even now, also, like, graphics matter a lot.
So really quick, I mean, you know, I definitely grew up in the time when, you know, I was a kid, you know scraping and stealing, yes, to get money to go to the arcades and play these games, right? And it says solo on this screen, but it was a pretty social event, right? And even, you know, talking about coming full circle, I mean, I used Bejeweled Blitz as an example just a minute ago. You want to beat those scores on there, just like you wanted to beat, you know, I think of a game like track and field, right? You know, I didn't know who, you know, whatever SBD was, the initials on the high score screen, but sometimes I wanted to stick around. If I knew I had a high score, right, at the pole vault or whatever, and some guy beat my score, I kind of wanted to hang around and see if that guy would show up because I wanted to see, you know, what he looked like. And that was... or she, right? And I think that, I mean, back then it was really like all guys at the arcade, right? But I think that definitely we've kind of come full circle, and here we are with all these games that are, you know, people call them that new and different, and they're really about the same as they were back then. They're very simple, easy to grasp concepts, and you are just fighting for your spot on a high score list, and you are really upset when someone knocks you off your perch.
Yeah, I think fundamentally, it's a different medium, like you said, but the fundamental aspects of games and play, this didn't affect it. It's something we crave, something we need, and this just gave us another way to do it.
Yeah.
Which I think it just gave us a different person to play against, too, because, like, yeah. I mean, take the example of Pac-Man here, like, if we were playing that game with other people, let's say, and they were controlling Ghosts and we were Pac-Man, like, it would play out in a very similar way, right? It would still just be like that the computer was playing against you instead of all these people getting up against you.
Yep.
So it really did. It just gave us, like, an extra buddy, you know?
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
Is there anything that fundamentally changed? Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
I was just going to say, just to let her answer, I think we've come around full circle in another way as well, where we've gone from it being a social experience at the arcade, but then also this battle for the high score, to it being kind of a multiplayer experience with online RPGs and so on, World of Warcraft stuff, and then coming back to a solo experience and a hyper-localized experience where it's not about a three-letter acronym of somebody I don't know. It's about my friend Joe, who's in Seattle, who I'm playing against, and I want to meet him.
Yeah. You had something to say back there.
Oh, yeah. I just wanted to comment on your comment earlier about the high score you wanted to be, and it could have been a he or a she, and everyone sort of laughed. And I thought it was interesting because as I've been hearing people talk about the gaming world, we've been talking about core games, and when casual games come up, people have said, oh, my girlfriend can play this, my mom can play this, my grandma can play this. And so I think the gender separation is a really interesting topic, and I think that's one thing that I noticed as someone who, you know, grew up in the 80s, and my first game console experience was watching my cousins play the NES and them telling me, like, I couldn't play because I was a girl. I feel like that was something I actually experienced with the advent of electronic gaming, is because computers were seen as more of a hobby for boys and men, that in some ways girls were excluded from the marketing of those games, and, you know, things like video game commercials and ads, you could see they were really targeted to boys.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one difference I feel like may not have been as prevalent before the advent of electronic games, was that sort of gender separation. And now when we talk about core versus casual, a lot of people are like to say things like, oh, casual games, that's great because it's getting women into this world. And, you know, I hope someday that won't be the distinction and we'll have, like, really awesome core games that appeal to girls.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
I think that... I think you have a lot of developers these days that are waking up to the fact that the need to play is core to the human condition and that it is not gender-based. To give a personal anecdote, my 7-year-old daughter, I joke, she was born with a controller in her hands. She had a 6-axis and was playing Little Big Planet at the age of 2. The minute she figured out that she could move the controller to the right and Sackboy would run, I just remember just this feeling of joy that she had. And she could barely even say a word. And she's just like, ah, this is great. She would just hold right on that first level. And just and now she's beat Little Big Planet 2, the entire Tales from Space series. We finish games almost every weekend together. And so, you know, as a focus group of one family, I can tell you that, you know, this need for play is absolutely universal, and electronic games are no exception.
I think just thinking about the human as an animal and as a species and how it takes a long time for a species to evolve, and thinking about, like, how did things change with the advent of digital gaming? If you look back at, like, ancient Roman societies or others, they had gladiatorial battles to the death. And I think that we forget, we're saying, like, oh, games and movies are desensitizing everybody to violence.
That was actual violence.
That's right. Yeah. And so I think that there is something really primal about all of this that we as a species, like, we haven't gone beyond that yet.
Yeah.
And I don't think we ever will.
I think you're absolutely right, yeah.
I went down like the headless the other way. You know, it's just not working for me. I'm not skilled at getting those two things together. Okay? However, I played, I played a bunch of God of War, and I like it because they sort of direct me in the right direction, so it's not frustrating for me. Yeah. And yet, if you look at it, it's a card game.
Yeah.
You know, I think we can all sort of agree on that. So the difference here is that, like, you know, I look at it in a way that I just don't want to have something that the learning curve is so hard. Yeah. For me, maybe for someone else it's you know, much easier, but for me it's like, and I get frustrated. I want to win. I want to be the last one all the time. I don't want 5-year-old kids to, you know, to be better than me. So, you know, I guess it's like, I think there are differences between the way women and men play, but I think we have to be careful, because it's not that we want to do only casual games. It's just that some things, you know, for us are more appealing than others, and they're not necessarily exactly the same thing.
All the women nodding their heads.
Yeah. So, but what was important to you about God of War? Was it the story? Was it the fact that it led you through?
Yeah. And I also really liked the fight with the bosses.
Yeah,
so that's awesome.
And I was like, all right, you know, I don't know where we're going now. I don't know if you know, I don't exactly know what we're supposed to do here, but just pass that part, and then we get some boss. I want to play.
That's cool.
I would just say, hey, yeah. Scoop, my turn.
Get out.
Sorry,
way in the back?
Yeah, first, I think Miss Pac-Man could be social and not solo and also hardcore because you could play tabletop against each other.
True.
I don't know if that's the best example.
Yeah, great point. These are meant for debate. So rip them to shreds.
Back to the women and men thing, I think that nobody's really talking about devices, and I think that iOS, I mean, especially iPhones and women's pockets, that will enable an entire audience of women to play games, especially... you know, social games, a part of, basically playing Words with Friends and becoming part of the game, or playing Words with Friends or Fruit Ninja or Angry Birds or any of these other types of games. So I think it kind of opens up, like, depending on the platform, a whole new genre and a whole new opportunity for that.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, and I honestly believe that, you know, those devices have, you know, definitely either introduced a whole bunch of new people in the world to gaming, or reminded them that gaming is out there and it's accessible to everybody. And I think that there's a lot of opportunity. This isn't just a Sony talk. I mean, for everybody, right? To get people re-engaged in games that are more than just words with friends, right? But that can go all the way into God of War, right? That, you know, just remind, hey, these are some great stories that can be told. Remember, games exist now, but you can play these amazing games on all these other platforms as well.
Best game of all time is Miss Pac-Man, by the way. Just for the record.
That is absolutely false, but you can have your opinion.
Debate.
Well, there's a lot of hands right now. I'm going to take someone new. Sorry, Gordon. So, way in the back.
Yeah, you know, getting to your question about what has changed, I think the advent of the computer has really brought in the era of automation. Just, you know, like, wow. That's essentially the next evolution.
Yeah.
And back in the 80s, when we were playing Dungeons and Dragons with dice and everything like that, there were certain logistics that had to be conquered, which is getting getting clearance from your parents, getting, you know, all meeting at a certain at a guy's house and things like that. Now, what WOW has done is said, okay, well, I can get 40 of you guys all online at the same time. You don't have to go anywhere. You don't have to deal with your parents. You don't have to sneak out and do anything like that. Just sit at home and all log on at the same time and join a raid. So I think that's a really big advantage that computers have enabled, because it's cleared away a lot of the logistics.
Yep.
That was sort of barriers.
Absolutely true. Yeah. You want to hit on this one?
You want to do this one for a minute? I just want to toss this question out. Is that social?
Or is it antisocial?
Yeah, or is it antisocial? Which is it?
There's just a lot of disturbed looks in the audience right now.
Who plays this game?
Who has played this game?
That's a better question, yeah.
Wow, really? Honestly? Only 3 or 4 people?
No.
Is there anybody watching?
That's right.
How many people have played this game?
That's right. We won't tell.
All right. Really? That's actually really surprising to me. But anyway, so is it social? Is it antisocial? Yeah.
I think to a degree it's both, because there are people who will sit there for 5 hours and have no concept of the outside world. I don't specifically know what this is. But if it's like a Facebook game...
Farmville.
Okay, Farmville.
Yes. Look, little game.
You'll find people who are posting stuff on other people's walls that are, oh, hey, I'll water my plants, or do stuff with my horses, or blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. That's this one. That's that one.
Expand on that. Yeah.
it builds this community of people who like take care of each other's farms and do all this stuff for each other.
Yeah.
I think there's an interesting thing about Farmville. Start talking about it within a social atmosphere. You talk to your friend and talk to your mom, you talk to your dad, and whatever, about I need stuff or I need nails. Or whatever. So there is a social aspect that actually pulls away from just the box.
Zynga. Single-handedly crippling the workforce of America.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Over here?
Yeah, I just kind of want to expand on that. I think Fargo probably leads to more social interaction, but I think the game itself isn't necessarily social. And I'm in the camp, I haven't played it, but from what I've seen, a lot of the wall posts and cross-pollination on social media that happens with this, a lot of it is like hashed, predefined text and stuff like that, and there doesn't really seem to be any sort of real-time social communication on like Warcraft or something. Like, people aren't necessarily chatting, saying what they want to each other and sharing their feelings. So like, I think like the game itself at its core isn't a social game. Just because it exists on a social network, okay, but I just think all the social interaction that stems from it is what makes it
awesome. I think, ironically, the game that this was based on, if we can say that about a Zynga game, the game that this was based on was called Farm Town, right? And that absolutely had that aspect to it. There were real-time lobbies or farms where essentially people got together in a marketplace and tried to interact and actually had real-time chat. And this one trumped it for whatever reason. Maybe it was simplicity. Maybe there were people that were intimidated by the thought of real-time chat. I'm not quite sure. Over here in the purple.
I think it's quite interesting to see that the social seems to reflect potentially the person's real-life personality as well. One game I played, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but Glitch, which is a browser-based, unfortunately, Flash game. But I seem to notice 3 types of people. So there's those who play the quests and the story very much for themselves. There's those who seem to do everything for everyone else. They donate meat. They bestow random kindness on people. They're very much there to help others. It's almost kind of baffling. There's those who are auctioning things to make money and to build up their own kind of empire. And to see those things,
real life. Yeah, it's definitely true.
Gordon, I've been holding off on you for a while.
I think they taught people a new mechanic. Like, for me, old, this is sort of like Street Fighter.
Yeah.
Like, when you had to learn Dragon Uppercut, and you could do it or you couldn't.
You got a long way to go to connect this segue.
Street Fighter, anybody?
To compel someone on their computer to do something for you on your farm is a new skill.
Yeah.
Like, it's this charisma skill, and whether you do it automated or by at the water cooler or by calling them and going, pretty please, stop what you're doing, go to Farmville and send this pail to me. That is a new skill. And I think that's sort of what they taught people, you know, that you have to do. They motivated, like, and you found people doing it who would never be that way before.
Interesting. You got about halfway there.
He's got the answer because he's taken the class. So
yeah.
I actually think going back to the original question is this game antisocial or social? I think it actually goes back goes to two things, which is game space and direct or indirect communication. So like if you're within, if you're in the game, so the game space is defined as you playing the game. A lot of your communication, whether you do with your friends or just people you meet, is going to be indirect because it's such a solo-based game with indirect confrontations outside the game. But the moment you leave that game space, you're still talking about the game, but then it becomes direct.
Mm.
So it's, I don't think it's ever going to be antisocial. It's always going to be more social.
What's happening? What's happening? What's that all about?
To your point earlier about how there are three different types of people in some of these communities, I also wonder too if some of it becomes a wish fulfillment and like this is who I would like to be. It's why people alter their states. It's like it lowers your ambition to behave the way you want to behave ordinarily.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like maybe the nicest person becomes the mercenary or vice versa. It like becomes a way so that you don't have to necessarily be accountable for your actions. It's like this other world where you can be whoever you want, you create whatever you want.
Love that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, totally.
Absolutely.
That's great.
And that was interesting too, I found, you know, that some people, you know, weren't really sharing, you know, and asking for, you know, a cow or, you know, an animal.
There's always such a thick layer of sarcasm when anyone talks about Farmville. I love it. I love it. It's true. Way in the back. Sure, of course.
Yeah, great point.
Absolutely, yeah.
Great point.
Yeah. The more direct ripoff came from Farm Town is all I'm saying, yeah.
But back to the social issue, I mean, games have been social, at least video games, I mean, with multiplayer since, I don't know, Atari or Nintendo. So it's like And I think that's kind of one of the social aspects of it. I mean, you talk about a hardcore game like Call of Duty, it's a lot more fun when you play multiplayer, but now you can play across networks.
I have a Asteroids cocktail in my apartment, and the reason why that game is significant for many reasons, but it was the first to have a leaderboard. And of course,
an Asteroids cocktail game, not an Asteroids cocktail. I just want to clarify that. Okay.
Yeah, good point. But it's amazing. Well, unfortunately, the leaderboard—it's got no battery, so you unplug the machine and wipes it out. But it's unbelievable how social that game is. You know, you just put it on two-player, and it's like it's leaderboard time.
That's cool.
Makes for a great weekend.
So what is this? Sorry, what kind of emotions does that stir up in this room? You know. After we're talking about social versus antisocial on a Facebook game, right? What does this mean to the people in this room?
Homework.
Homework.
There's a game I have to use for my class.
I have to play a game tonight.
Here we go. Right. World of Warcraft.
So I think this is probably like the other opposite end of the social spectrum, in which social games tend to be more social when you talk about the whole like walking up to the arcade cabinet. Or sitting next to each other on the couch, you know, with your friends and things like that. Most of the time, you're going to have a positive interaction, and you're going to want to help each other, and it's more cooperative. All right, let me preface this by saying I used to be a video leader. you definitely have positive interaction, but with that comes a lot of stress, possibly. And even in it's that top layer of cooperative nature,
there's always that competitive nature, me first kind of thing. Even dumps, you know, things like loot drops and stuff like that, like, and it just kind of sometimes brings out the worst.
I want to ask you a scary question. How did you stop becoming a guild leader? Like, what? How did you? How did you? So, but you just, so you left. Did you hand the reins over to somebody else, or did you just disappear one day? Uh oh, you have to admit.
Here come the tears.
I'm entertained. I'm sorry. Yeah.
You know, we had the radio structure set up, and I was like, "So I'm not gonna play anymore. I'm just gonna disappear." And
so you said you were clear about it, at least. I get it.
Yeah, that's good. Back up in place. I didn't.
Okay, good.
And all these yeah, I just and to your point, it was like in order to stop being a guild leader, I had to literally stop.
It's literally it was a job. It was a job.
Yeah. It was a job.
Sorry, way in the back, right there.
And, you know, the first Dungeons & Dragons video game came out, and it was like, okay, now we can actually play that fantasy, or realize visually that fantasy that we've always had in our heads. So when I first started playing WoW, I was like, okay, I guess I better see what this is about. It blew my mind just about the openness of that. But what I thought they did really well, and what I thought made the game sticky, was actually the social aspect of it. It was not the world, and not the quests, and not the graphics, or anything like that, but you end up in a a bad thing for you, but it's you end up playing with these people every day, and you, even though I don't really know who, you know, Zakari is or Melkor's Angel is.
I love that guy.
Yeah.
Totally. That guy's totally cool.
Best tank ever. But you feel like responsibility to them, you start to know them, you hang out with them. It's like they're kind of like your online family. And I
totally.
Thought that would really make yeah. WoW important to me, at least. It's like, I like those people, and I want to go play with them.
Yeah.
And it's not the game, you know, Star Wars is.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So I have a unique view on this because I've been a game master of those games for about 4.5 years now. I've interacted with every single type of player in this game. They are all up on the spectrum. There are the antisocial people who want to join the game and just be everything by themselves. There are the extreme social people who want to be everything with everyone. There are the achievers who are just in it for the achievements. There's the questers who want to be literally do every single person.
And the griefers.
People who come in literally just get harassed with people and get the big stick out of it. So I had these interactions with these people, you know, dealt with them trying to help me. I went actually read, you know, Bridge of the Gap between Casual and Hardcore. This is what I thought of.
Yep.
Because the polarization of the player base is so massive. You know, going on forums and, you know, just reading what the hardcore crowd is saying, it's a small crowd.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Spoken that I almost am afraid that they're going to speak so loudly that the casuals who don't go on the forums and make up at least 75% of the player base.
That's a good point.
They get drowned out because, you know, the hardcore is so much more
vocal.
Yeah.
So much more vocal, and they're not always right, you know, but they're so loud and they're
absolutely, absolutely. They change the opinions of others as well.
That's right.
I think we're running a little short on time, and I kind of want to get. We have 10 more minutes. So do you want to fly through some of these?
Can
slides?
I burn through?
Yeah.
Because this is sort of a narrative. We are going somewhere. We're on a journey together.
I don't know where we're going.
Okay. Mobile games are a revolution. It just happened in the last couple of years.
I mean, that's one of the greatest games of all time.
Yeah.
Come on.
Just this, show of hands, right? Who had this? That's right.
That was a big hand.
That's right. I love the scouts here playing it, walking along. I found that on the internet. I'm like, yes, I was that kid.
Well, that actually looks like Merlin if I can see it properly.
Oh, maybe right. Yeah, this guy, yeah. I think. Maybe.
Yeah, right. That's cool. So what kind of emotions does this slide stir up?
I just have that Nintendo pop-up Mario device.
Game & Watch, maybe?
It was a Nintendo device that you could play like Chutes and Ladders, that Mario.
Yeah, yeah. So now, how much has, you know, I mean, of course, iOS, but the fact that, you know, so many people own iPhones today, how much has that changed the world of mobile? Because when you first started talking mobile games, say, you know, 7-8 years ago, right, on Razors or whatever, right, it just didn't quite work. There was such a step below what you could do on other portable devices, and now you've got these, you know, quick access to all these games on iOS. What's that doing to the gaming society?
Now, is this more portable or mobile?
Doesn't matter.
So yeah. Obviously, I think someone mentioned earlier, they just kind of opened the door to more casual gaming, especially with iOS and Android games, and the price points of their entries way lower than, you know, buying, you know, the DS or the Vita or something like that, and the $40-$50 games. So you're definitely, you know, that's why things like Rovio and Angry Birds is such a big deal now. That would never happen.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's because of that little price point, and then the, you know, so much opener for, you know, casual people, because everyone has a phone.
Sure.
Before we get the answer, let's get you.
I think also to that point, it opens up a lot of doors for, like, developer possibilities. You have people who are, like, literally just learn how to make a game in their own bedroom in their spare time. And so you see a greater variety of genre, you know, really redefining what makes a game. And I think that has from that, and that to me has been one of the biggest changes I've seen in the last few years, is just opening up the genre and doing things that the big, no offense, but, you know, the big box companies aren't always out there doing these.
What's a big box company? No,
never heard of one.
Really quick, I mean, I often think that it's oftentimes the hunt for games in the vast desert that is like the App Store, for example. I often, you know, find that it's that might be more fun than actually playing the games itself. I mean, true, does anyone agree with that? Yeah.
I want to keep burning.
Yeah,
because we don't have much time. Okay. This is a story. This is a journey. Anybody know this game? That's not out yet. What is that? And Dust 514, that's right. And why did I write free here? That's right. Free to play. Anybody know what that means? What's that doing to games? Free to play. Is it truly free? Yeah.
What'd you say?
Some games are going to be truly free to play. Others will be microtransaction based, which I'm assuming this game will be. You can load it up, you can probably download it off PSN, play it. But if you want your character to look different, or maybe have a special gun, $4.
Of course. I mean, there's very few fully free-to-play games. I mean, you know, there's a few people that just do it for the art form, and that's great. But most free-to-play games, of course, are just like that, yeah.
Does this change games in any way? Is this a revolution, or is this something that we've seen for a very long time and it's just taking a new form, yeah?
Things like recently TF2 went free to play. I never wanted to check out TF2 until it went free to play. I was like, I'm gonna try it. It's a huge thing. People love it. I tried it. I absolutely love it. I'm terrible at it, but I love it. And I ended up buying it. And if it wasn't for that, the free to play, I would never have paid any attention to it.
All right, go on. I teased you too much. Go on.
I think it sort of affects how developers create games, whether that be they develop with free-to-play in mind and then we're going to take stuff out and make charge people for it, or they're going to, whether it's, they can go to the pro-consumer side and they develop and they add new stuff that players would really enjoy and then charge them for it if they're willing to pay for it.
That's right. Couple notes on this game. It's interesting about this is the model, the actual business model that they're basing this game on is not unlike the business model of that farm simulator we saw earlier. And so for the very first time, you're seeing the farm simulator model applied to games that are shooters and more hardcore. So it's this very interesting collision of worlds that we're seeing right now in games like this.
The real interesting model for trying to make free games work like this is the stuff that's behind you in the game, and it just looks like America.
So is that the devil or is that okay? I'm curious.
The,
yeah.
That it's good or bad.
Yeah.
You know, maybe you can pay $1 a month and you don't have to do all that stuff.
Yeah.
We're done with that. Like,
yeah.
But where you can start putting that into there, because it's something that we've already, sorry for basic movies, TV shows, or anything like that.
Sure.
But I think that they're starting to merge more into being,
yeah.
But it's not really getting as much
totally.
Media.
We're going to go rapid fire for the last couple minutes. Way in the back, there's someone that hasn't asked a question yet. Go ahead.
So do you think this is the proposed bridge between sort of casual and core? I think I do model of we've seen might like casual and look at HLN, the budget and stuff like that, games that are sort of trying to free the play model of this provide for the experts. Those aren't really super casual audiences.
Yeah. I don't think so. I mean, we're definitely not here to propose a bridge per se. I think we're just here to kind of spark conversation.
Yeah.
I think there's going to be a lot of little tiny bridges, is my opinion.
That's
and
right.
this is probably one of them.
That's right. And in fact, we had a very interesting discussion at the beginning of this session debating whether this title even makes sense.
Yeah.
Right? Is there such a thing as a core or a casual? Or is it the player, not the game?
Let's keep burning.
We're on a journey.
Less than 5 minutes left.
What's all that about?
See, I love that reaction, honestly. It makes me laugh, right? So, and is that everybody? Is that the core? Is it, do kids love it? What, I mean, almost universally everyone in this room almost threw up when we put this slide up here. So what, why? So, wow, lots of hands. Somebody new. Go ahead. You haven't talked for a while. Yeah.
I'm kind of shocked by the massive reaction, negative reaction to motion. And I almost wonder more if it's the technology or the interest of the developer. I mean, as a gamer, motion gaming, to me, the potential that it has is awesome. But nobody has embraced that potential and pushed it to a level where it fulfills that fantasy.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody who's a Star Wars fan, how many times have you grabbed anything and pretended like it was a lightsaber?
Never.
the aspect of motion gaming, of fulfilling that fantasy of now I can be a Jedi and I have a lightsaber and what I do on the screen is fully replicated.
Yeah.
The potential is there.
And that's base, and
let's go,
there's lava
let's go
there.
Rapid fire here, way in the back, because we got like 2 minutes.
I just wanted to point on that fact that I really fully think it's the reason that we are grown and known about it is fully the developer's faults right now. I think that for instance, in this case, Sony has come up with a great piece of hardware. And a great point to this of the developers need to figure out is for those who are familiar with Johann Sebastian Joust. Which is a great game. I got a chance to see it last week at GDC.
It's awesome. Absolutely awesome. Yeah.
Like that's using motion controls, and it's using it in a way that's not the typical. It's not just taking a controller and converting it to motion.
Yep.
We're burning.
Yep.
What about eMotion? Anybody know this game?
Journey.
All right. What's so special about this? How did you feel when you played this? Did it make you feel anyway? Do you remember that experience? Do you remember that feeling?
That chirping was cool. It's that feeling you get when you play Shadow of the Colossus.
Yeah.
And you're alone, but it's also social, and you're not always alone. I mean, there's a lot of different emotions that can be stirred up from a single game. And I love what you said, don't know if it's a game or not. I think that it's something that, the guys that built this are really proud of that sort of statement. Of course.
All of them? Checkers? Is that a great game? Does it?
Emotional victory.
I like that. Yeah. Flip the board over.
1 minute. Is there another slide or is that it?
Oh, I got a couple more. Location. The fact that your game now knows where you are.
I see some head shaking. I see some whatevers. Anyone love this? Anyone hate it?
I'm a big fan.
Yeah. Yes. Me too.
I think that how they're doing it all right now is just terrible.
It's early stages.
I tried all these other, all these location-based things. And I keep going back to Foursquare because it has some game mechanics, the game tanks in it. Like the worst fucking game mechanics we've ever had.
We're moving. Yeah.
when augmented reality becomes incorporated with that better.
Oh. I think. And then right after that one is the future. And that's my last slide.
Location-based gaming, more attractive.
Yeah. Everybody know AR, augmented reality?
Mm-hmm.
So I want to paint a picture as we end this slide. Imagine 5 years from now we have the session again and we have electronic games, which are massive and social, that are both casual and hardcore, that have the ability to know where you are in the world, and you can move using motion control your body to other places in this world. And you have computer-generated images that you can't tell the difference between those images and the real physical things around you. Imagine that world. And then let's all go build it. What do you think? All right.
I feel like Marty McFly sitting next to Doc right now. You know what? I think we're out of time. So thank you very much. I, you know, you guys were great.
Thank you.